Welcome everyone to this session where I am super excited to be talking with JJ Virgin. Firstly, JJ, welcome and thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
So I think this is going to be a really important interview. My sense is of part of what we're doing in this interview is exploring the lived journey of what people go through when they experience what I think is probably one of the most traumatic things that one can go through in their life. Before we come into it, I'm sure many people will know who JJ is, but just to give her professional background, triple board certified nutrition expert and fitness hall of famer, JJ Virgin is a passionate advocate of eating and exercising smarter. JJ and her team help people stay fired up and healthy as they age, so they feel the best they ever had at 40 plus, which is good for me because I turn 40 in about a month's time, so I should be staying in touch. JJ is a prominent TV and media personality whose previous features include co-host of TLC's Freaky Eaters, 2 years as the on-camera nutritionist for Weight Loss Challenges on Dr. Phil, and numerous appearances on PBS, Dr. Oz, Rachel Ray, Access Hollywood, and The Today Show. She also speaks regularly and has shared the stage with notables such as Seth Godin, Lisa Nichols, Gary Vaynerchuk, Mark Hyman, Dan Buettner, and Mary Morrissey. JJ is the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, The Virgin Diet, The Virgin Diet Cookbook, JJ Virgin's Super Impact Diet, and JJ Virgin's Sugar Impact Diet Cookbook. Her latest book, which is what we're going to be exploring today, Warrior Mom, 7 Secrets to Bold, Brave Resilience, shows caregivers everywhere how to be strong, positive leaders for their families while exploring the inspirational lessons JJ learned as she fought for her own son's life. As I've been reading some of your book, JJ, over recent days, one of the things that was very prominent in my mind as a father of 3 daughters is I think the greatest trauma as a parent we can go through is the potential fear that we're going to lose one of our children. And I found it very moving reading some of your story. Just to sort of frame this, back in 2012, JJ's 16-year-old son Grant was hit by a hit-and-run driver. And that obviously catalyzed an enormous journey for both JJ and her son and the families. You want to, JJ, just open perhaps a little bit, just by telling us a little bit of the story of what happened.
Sure. And also, the book could also be called Warrior Dad. So, so you know, it actually started out as Miracle Mindset. And, you know, as I really started to dig into it, it's really about being a warrior and, you know, being a caretaker. And when you get down to it, we're all caretakers, right? Now more than ever. And where we really need to start is with ourselves. So I agree with you. I always said that I could handle anything as long as my kids were healthy and happy and safe. And I'm now going to take it further to I can just handle anything, but I had to go through this to prove it. So it was a very interesting time, and some of this actually isn't in the book of what everything that was going on at the time that even just compounded this. I was a single mom, and basically the financial support for my 2 sons, they were 15 and 16. And that first book you mentioned, The Virgin Diet, was coming out in a month. Now, when you're writing a book, the easiest part of writing a book is writing the book. The biggest challenge in writing a book is launching that book. It takes so much energy to do that. And I had invested the entire book advance into the launch of the book. I'd also borrowed some money. I was determined. I knew that this was going to be the thing. Like, this was going to be the catalyst that could help me get my message out into the world and also help set a future up for my family. And so I went all in, right? And they say, if you want to take the island, you got to burn all the boats. My boats were burned, Alex. I was like in. And it's this month before, my son goes out, crosses the street, like going to a friend's house. And the next thing I know, my 15-year-old son, Bryce, Grant was 16 at the time, comes running into the house and says, Grant's been hit by a car and airlifted to the local hospital. Now, I mean, think of all the things that would run through your mind at that point, because they don't airlift you for a broken leg or a broken arm. I don't have any information, even calling the hospitals, we're racing to the hospital because he didn't have any information on him. The only reason we knew that he had been airlifted was a policeman saw my son Bryce and said, a kid got hit and looked just like you, because they were 1 year apart.
Wow.
Yeah, they Irish twins, we call them. So we get to the hospital. And, you know, it'd been so interesting before that. And if anyone's a working parent, they kind of get this is, you know, I kept writing in my journal every day. I'm present for my children. I'm present for my children, but I wasn't doing anything about it. And when I was working, I was feeling guilty that I wasn't with my kids. When I was with my kids, I wasn't really there. I was working in my mind, you know, I mean, that whole work-life balance thing to me is BS. It's more like find the harmony, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, here I am racing to the hospital with a bag. I'd thrown my laptop and all this stuff with me. What am I thinking? Running to the hospital. I've got it with me. We go into a conference room. The doctor walks in and says, your son's been hit by a car and he is in life-threatening situation. And he's going to die sometime in the next 24 hours. He has a torn aorta that kills 90% of the people on the scene. And he's got multiple brain bleeds. And the only way that he could survive this is if he had a surgery, but we don't do the surgery at this hospital. And he said, you know, if we airlifted him to the next hospital, he'd never survive it. And even if he were to survive that, if we did the surgery, he probably wouldn't survive that. And even if he were to do both of those, he'd be so brain damaged, it wouldn't be worth it. And, you know, my son, Bryce, my mathematician son, looks at that doctor like, and fortunately, my son, Bryce, and both my kids had always been trained, first of all, to kind of defy authority. And
that's question
authority a little bit. But also to see the possibility, right? And so the possibility Bryce saw was that it wasn't zero, that it was 0.25% chance. And Bryce looked at that doctor and he goes, we'll take those odds. And I walked outside and I went outside and I just got quiet. I got present and I listened. And my question was just, Grant, what do you want? You know, because when you're in a situation like that, and they brought us to see Grant, and Grant was covered in road rash. I mean, it was a picture I'll never get out of my mind, where he's bloody, there's glass sticking out, there's bones. I remember looking, going, there are bones sticking through his skin. He's on a ventilator. He's got a tube coming out of his brain. Machines are beeping. And I walk outside and I said, Grant, what do you want? I just got present and I listened because, you know, I thought I want to do what he wants. I don't know what the future, what if I go through all this stuff and I bring him back and he's a vegetable? What do I do? Who do I fight? And I got it. Like I was standing there and I just get this hit, like fight for me, mom, which is where Warrior Mom, after I published it the first time, I was like, oh. And so we went in and we said, we're overruling you, to this doctor, who was very angry, by the way, like that we were going to overrule him. And we got him airlifted to the next hospital where we had five surgical teams were there assembled and ready to do what they, in fact, the doctor who was in charge used a stent put into him that was as part of a study that was supposed to be used for adults. And it was, the study was over. He goes, you know, I figured I'd ask for forgiveness, which is the type of surgeon you want, right? So he survived the airlift. He survived that surgery. And then I went in to see him. And first the orthopedic surgeons had put in his rods. I go see the neurosurgeons. They go, we don't think he'll ever wake up. I just thought, you know, I'm just not going to listen to you. I went in to see him and I'm standing there and he's got all the machines beeping. He's in a deep coma, multiple brain bleeds. He's got one finger there. I grabbed that finger and I said, Grant, I love you so much. And, you know, the machines are beeping, nothing happens. And I said, your brother is here and he loves you so much. And I feel a squeeze, but that wasn't supposed to happen, right? Because he's in a deep coma.
He's already defied the odds at that point.
Right. Yeah. And I feel it. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm really tired. And then I throw out, and Grammy loves you so much, and I get nothing. And then I said, and your girlfriend, Mackenzie, loves you so much. And I get the squeeze of the finger and the attempt to kind of lift my hand up. And I was like, he is in there and he can hear me. And from that moment on, I remember looking at him. I said, Grant, you're a warrior. Your name means warrior. And you're going to be 110%. And this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to you. Because I fully believe that, you know, thoughts create. And I was going to make sure that he knew that we were fighting for him and he had to fight. and that I was bringing everything he needed to get him to 110%. And that became my mantra from that moment on, was what do I need to do to help my son become 110%?
But that's a remarkable way to respond to such a ultimately traumatic experience. One of the things that touched me in the book is, and I'm not sure if it was before this surgery, it might have been a later surgery, but you wrote an email to friends and you signed off the email saying, "Please pray for my son. I don't need your pity, but I need your strength." And I thought that was very touching about what we really need in those moments of crisis.
Yeah. That was actually that first day I went. Now, it was very interesting. The first, like when I first went and saw him in the hospital, it was like I was watching a movie. I thought it was like, this could not possibly be real. I think your brain must do that to go, this is not real. This could not be happening, right? As they were preparing him to put him on the helicopter, and we did not know. I mean, they said he probably won't survive a helicopter ride. Like his aorta was going to rupture at any minute. And I'm standing in this room with my ex-husband and my son, Bryce. And then I went through the whole, like, it's my fault. Like, you know, that whole thing. I shouldn't have let him walk down the street, like all that stuff. And my son, Bryce, is acting. He's I feel like he's Yoda. You know, he's so old beyond his
sense. Certainly sounds like it. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, "Mom, this is not your fault." He walks back in to see Grant before we all have to leave Grant. And he goes, "Dude, you look really ugly right now, but if anyone can get through this, you can," you know? And I'm like, who is this kid and how does he have this strength? But you know, after as I was driving to LA, it was a 2.5 hour drive that I left at, you know, 2 in the morning. I just called friends. I started calling friends on the West Coast. As it got a little later, I started calling friends on the East Coast, and I just let them lean in. Like I let them, I was like going, "I can't feel him. I can't." And they just said, "He's going to be through this." I just leaned into them. And then, you know, once I got to that point, as he was in surgery, that was the letter I wrote, because I knew that I could not go through this alone. And, you know, in life, like I was never someone to ask for help. It's vulnerable. You feel weak. It's scary. When your son's life's on the line, there's a lot of stuff that you never would have done before that you do. But one thing that I've really learned from that is that we are meant to do that. We're meant to lean in with each other. I mean, that's probably the biggest challenge right now in this pandemic is to just not being able to be together and be strong together and lean in together. So I sent that letter out and said, "Listen, I need your strength, not your sympathy." And people just poured in. They came to visit in the hospital. They made me want to be a better person. I thought, would I be doing this? Like people I didn't even know drove hours to come pray for Grant. People were bringing us food baskets. It was amazing. And I let them all in, you know, like let them really in and just let that strength in. And man, it really helped.
There's something about having such an intense situation where those normal defenses get sort of blown out.
Yeah. Right?
That it's like you can't respond in the conditioned normal way because you're too much in shock, in a sense.
Yeah. And what's interesting, you know, I wrote that whole book and I talked about the lessons that I learned while I went through this, but here's the real, the reality of that I didn't realize till after, because so many people, as I was going through this experience, because part of what I was going to tell you that I didn't get to yet is that I had that book coming out and I actually had to launch that book, which I'll get to in a moment, from bedside with my son in a coma, you know, and people kept saying, "How did you manage to pull all this off? And, you know, tell me how you did it. Give us the lessons." But I realized that what really I had been training my whole life to be able to handle this level of stress. And so I think that we need to reframe the challenges that we go through, the trauma that we go through, as we learn how to process through it, that when you learn these tools, that you learn how to bring gratitude in, how to ask for help, how to practice forgiveness, that these become tools that help you deal with higher and higher levels of stress and trauma, right?
I think one of the things that I think a lot of the conversation around trauma, and for understandable reasons, can be that how trauma causes suffering and wounds and sort of damage that has to be healed. But I think you're speaking to a very important point that actually when one goes to the gym, what one actually does is they cause a form of trauma to their muscle. They tear the muscle and the muscle grows back stronger as a result of that. And it strikes me that in a sense, physically, you were in great shape and you had a physical capacity that meant you could be driving through the night and you could handle that pressure on your system. But also you'd grown your capacity that things that one could frame as being negative, bad traumas had actually been the preparation.
Yeah, they were research and development. And so that first night, the first 24 hours, that next night, I'm now in the ICU. They've moved him to the pediatric ICU. He is front and center, middle in the pediatric ICU. He looks like the Incredible Hulk because he's so swollen. And I'm standing there and I'm thinking, it's going to be 110%. I had to keep that in my brain. Like I wouldn't let any picture of him, anything less than 110% in. And so he had to be 110%. And I'll tell you how I learned how to do that technique. Cause it's a really simple technique that can make all the difference. But I thought, all right, I'm not leaving. Turns out like number one death, cause of death for children is brain injury. One of the top three leading causes of death is death by doctor, like death in the hospital. So I'm not leaving. And if I don't make this book go, I will be bankrupt and I will not be able to help my son get to be 110% because this is going to cost a lot of money. What the heck do I do now? And I realized that in order to help to save my son's life, be there still for my other son, and get this book to go bigger than I had imagined it to be before, that the first thing I had to do was put my self-care on the top of the list. And it helped me really reframe this whole idea. Like I wrote a book that was to help with weight loss. And in weight loss, the biggest thing that happens is people tell you they'll do it tomorrow. And I kept thinking to myself, like, I thought, here I am. And what if I hadn't walked in at the top of my game? You know, what if like the level of stress I had to handle, the sleep issues at first, I mean, what if I hadn't walked in the top of my game? I immediately set up my situation so I could get the sleep I needed, have great food. I had stress supplements. One of my doctor friends walked in with a bag of stuff, Dr. Hyla Cass. So I set up my whole environment to be able to be successful and handle that level of stress. It was super duper important. But I'd also been training for it for years. I'd had a mentor early on in my 30s, who taught me that in order to be better in business and better in life, it's all about your mindset. You know, mindset's a muscle, just like you talked about. And one of the first things she taught me was the minute you had a limiting belief, she had me wear these rubber bands around my wrist. And whenever I had a limiting belief, she taught me to snap it and say, cancel, cancel.
That's good old school psychology. That's great.
I did that for, like, I lived at her house I moved in. So, I mean, I still have the like mental cancel, cancel. And so, and she taught me that thoughts create and that there are no limitations. They're only in your mind. And so I sat there, looked at Grant, went, you're going to be 110%, which it doesn't exist, right? And I just was like, went from that premise forward. And even though the doctor's like, okay, this is crazy lady over here, they started treating him with more possibility. Yeah. You know, it just, things started to shift because of that Grant is going to be 110%. And plus, that's the questions I was asking. Like, it's a very different question. How do I help my son survive versus how do I get my son to be 110%?
And I think mindset is infectious, right? When you're coming from mm-hmm. that kind of perspective, it impacts the people around you. But one of the things that also really strikes me, JJ, is that I often think when we're going through an enormously challenging life situation, we need this sort of interesting mix of the sort of strength and the sort of the discipline and the commitment you're talking about with what you've also spoken to, which is that place of surrender and that place of letting go and that place of trust. And I wonder what helped you navigate those, because both of those capacities were there. How did you know when it was time to fight and push and when it was time? Because I think people can get too caught in either, like they're fighting so much they burn out from the fight, or they're surrendering so much that they're a victim of the circumstance. And I wonder how you navigated that.
I tend to be the one that jumps in and fights. my ex-husband tends to be the one that sits back and surrenders. And so it actually was, and then I had some, I had a really great friend who is an amazing psychologist. She's a professor at Pepperdine, and she would come over a couple times a week and just sit with me. And I don't know what would have happened if she hadn't done that, truthfully, because I would have probably been in fight mode all day long, right? My ex-husband would help temper me. He'd come in with flowers and everything else and go, okay, chill it, you know? But she would come, and it was like someone just gave you a blankie. It's the only way I could explain it. She'd come and just sit. And it's a really important lesson if you are have a friend or family member who's going through a challenging time, because you know, you don't know what to say, right? You don't need to say a thing. She would just come over and sit. And it was so soothing and comforting, and that I could just breathe and let my guard down, you know? And so I think if anything, that's what helped me, is that she helped me kind of just sit, trust, and take a deep breath, because it wasn't going to be like, I felt like I was kind of like guard up, adrenaline up a lot of the time.
In a sense, she was doing for you in a small way what you were doing for Grant, in a sense of just being there as a loving presence.
Yeah. And I also knew, it was very interesting, because I had some energy medicine. When this happens, I had people sending me Tibetan scrolls, holy water. They were like lighting candles in Catholic churches in France. I'm like, great, we'll take it all. Like,
yeah, we're not selective.
Yeah. I'm like, all of it, want it all. Like, let's do everything. Now I don't remember where that was going.
You were talking about your friend coming and sitting with you and having that presence and having that support of someone being there and it not necessarily.
Oh, yes. Okay. So someone sent me an energy healer who was had nearly died, near death experience. She was like, Grant had a near death experience. And he would call me as I was driving to the hospital every morning at like 5:36 in the morning and tell me what was going on with Grant. And the first time, you know, a friend says, hey, I'm going to have this guy call you. And I'm like, oh, brother, right? And okay, I'll humor you because you're trying to be helpful. Fine. And I'm talking to this guy. I walk in and he says, Grant's blood pressure is up. Just hold the phone up. I'm going to bring it down. Walk in, Grant's blood pressure is up. I can see it on the machine. He does whatever thing he does. It comes down. I'm like, all right. But he also made me realize as I started to watch that is Grant and I have always been very, very in tune. And if I'm upset and anxious, Grant's upset and anxious. And so I knew that if I was going to be around Grant, I had to be calm. I couldn't be, if I was going to like need to go out, like I only really actually lost it once in the hospital, which I was pretty thrilled about, you know, but the person that I yelled at, it was a friend of mine. I yelled at them. They like anything I was upset at ever in my whole life, he got yelled at for, but I apologized after.
Need that person sometimes.
Yeah. He's like, I knew what you were doing. That was okay. It was fine. He goes, just let me have it. Yeah. But I also knew that with Grant, that whatever I came in, I had to come in totally confident. I had to come in knowing he was going to be 110%. I couldn't let any of that stuff. I knew he could feel it and I knew he could hear me. And he even said, you know, Mom, when the gray man came down and asked me if I wanted to live or die, I really wanted to stay over there. It's amazing over there. He goes, but I kept hearing your voice.
Wow.
So I decided to come back. So, you know, I think that energy, you know, Jim Rohn talks about that was, that your income's the average of the five people you hang out with. It's not your income. It's your mindset. It's your weight. It's your everything. So, and it can be infectious. I was so clear on the things where Grant was going to be and, you know, pulling people in for this that everybody starts to rally to the cause, right?
So I've got this picture of, and I think Warrior Mum truly is the right title for the book. I've got this image of you as the Warrior Mum being there for your son with the sort of army of supporters kind of coming in whilst launching a book. And so we know the book was a blockbuster, but tell us how the story moved from there.
So where do you want me to jump in from?
Well, I guess particularly the piece actually that I'm curious about here is as the story was unfolding and moving forward, mm-hmm. and Grant started to make signs of progress and started mm-hmm. to respond to that treatment, one of the things that I think can also be very tricky in these situations is I'm sure there were many, many micro decisions along the way. Like, do we go this direction or do that direction? Do we? And I think that's also true for many people that are on their own healing journey, that one can almost get in an analysis paralysis about every decision that has to be made. And one of the other lessons that I really liked in the book is you made the point that you can't course correct when you're right. standing still. You have to be moving to get the feedback and the information.
And by the way, I push the doctors faster than they wanted to go. I feel like I'm a mom. I know I really, really could feel where he was at. So I was pushing a little faster, like early on when he was just coming out of the coma, which by the way, in the movies, when they come out, if someone comes out of a coma and opens her eyes and says, I love you. It is not like that.
It's not.
And all the doctor said was when he wakes up, it will be ugly. But I didn't know that they meant 5 years of that. Wow. And that when someone comes out of a brain injury, they come out over time, especially when it was one at the level, the highest severity of a brain injury you can have, which is what he had. And when he first woke up, all he did was stare off into space to the side and move an arm. The only arm that wasn't, the only body part that wasn't in a cast, he moved it back and forth all day long and stared off into space and his eyes were vacant. And I remember thinking, like, to manage a mindset at that point where you're going, and I had to just find those signs every single day. So I started looking for them. So what I did was I started using essential oils because I could see his nose wiggle. I started getting popsicles and because I want to see if he could sense cold, if he could, sense sweet. And I just started playing with his senses. And what I was looking at was just like, how do I wake up his senses? As he started to connect more, I still remember when he actually started to make eye contact with me and started to smile. And I was doing touch. I had someone come in with and doing acupressure. I started throwing a ball at him. And, I just, whatever they said, I kind of pushed a little further. I had a Nutribullet in there. He spit out his own feeding tube. And then I was like, game on. I'm all in now.
That's the sign I was waiting for.
Yeah. I was like, here we go. And I would give him stuff. And I remember once I fed him too fast because he had to learn how to eat all over again. He had to learn how to eat, how to talk, how to tie his shoes, how to go to the bathroom, how to brush his teeth, everything. It was like having a 16-year-old baby. And I fed him too fast. And he proceeded to throw it all up. And I'm like going, oh, oops, but I just kept pushing it a little bit. I pushed it with the supplements and I looked at risk reward because one of the things that you know when you have someone in a coma is that the longer they stay in the coma, the higher the risk is they'll always be in the coma and they'll die. And then he had cachexia, he was wasting away. So I was like going, I got to get this stuff, these nutrients in him. It's certainly not going to be from hospital food. And even when we had him we moved him from one hospital to the next hospital because the hospital that saved his life was not a rehab hospital. And when we moved him to the next one, there got to be a point where I knew, even though they wanted to keep him there and it would have been easier to keep him at that hospital, it was very structured. I built my office into part of his hospital room, but we had nurses and rehab people on all day, every day with him. And he was in a zipped up posy bed because he'd get so violent sometimes coming out of the brain injury. And it would have been way easier to keep him there. But I knew that he'd gotten as far as he could there. And the doctors were like, no, he needs to be here at least 4 to 6 more weeks. Well, as soon as his blood pressure was stabilized, which was the one I was looking for, I was like, we're gonna take him out. Because I just felt like if he was at home with recognizable things, we would progress faster than there. And that made it a lot harder. I'm not going to lie. I mean, hard and scary, but I think it was a necessary thing. And who knows? I can't go back. Maybe that was the wrong move. But I think the worst thing you can do is nothing. And I'm an entrepreneur. We take risks and we stay in action, right? So
I laughed out loud at one point where in the book where there was a scene where the doctor said, one of the things I want you to do is play table tennis and to play it as much as you can. And before he got a chance to respond, you was like, yep, Grant loves table tennis. That sort of, there's something about that sort of, that determination and that sort of radical commitment that you'll do whatever it takes. You mentioned earlier the analogy of if you're going to take an island, burn the boats. But there's something about that sort of, and but my question is, I wonder what supported, what had cultivated that level of conviction and commitment from you, do you think?
I think everyone would, you know, it's so many people have said, I don't know, I couldn't do what you did. And I go, you never know, you know, we're never better than when we're challenged. You're a parent, you're sitting here looking at your kid. You hear about moms lifting cars off their kids, right? I mean, I think when you're looking at your child and the quality of their life, there's nothing, right? I think most of it, there's nothing we won't do for it. And for them. And so,
but there's something particular, I think, about going against, not going against, but questioning the path that's being laid in front of you.
Well, you know, I'm very fortunate in that I had a lot of graduate and doctoral courses in science and taken a lot of work in functional medicine. And my friends were all doctors. And so all along the way, I was doing basically a risk reward analysis. I was never going to put my son's life in danger, but I knew that a bigger danger was not progressing. And so all along the way, I had amazing people that I was consulting with. I mean, Dr. Daniel Amen was coming to the hospital. So I had incredible people helping me because yes, I was doing stuff against behind the doctor's backs at the hospital. I was giving him higher dose fish oil. I kicked up vitamin D, but I knew what those things were. And I also knew from my background in nutrition and functional medicine is that the hospitals are very traditional and they lag way behind. And that he had a far bigger risk not taking these things than taking them. So I just figured out how to get it to him.
I guess at this point in the story, where you know Grant's sort of home and he's obviously made enormous progress from the initial accident. But as you say, it's a very gradual and it's a very bumpy process when one is recovering from.
Oh boy!
One of the things that also strikes me is that often what happens when we go through a trauma is initially that there's that massive hit of adrenaline and stress hormones. That sort of we adapt temporarily, and then at some point there's normally an enormous crash that happens. What's interesting here is it wasn't just dealing with that situation. It was also a book launch, which is an ongoing and grueling process. It's then getting him home, and I want to go back to what you kind of mentioned it earlier about that your self-care was critical. But say a bit more about how critical and how you were fitting that in, because normally, a bit like you were saying with weight loss, people say I'll start tomorrow. When it comes to self-care and crisis, people say, well, I don't have the time to do it.
Yeah, we'll make time. I had a great mentor early on in nutrition. He goes, if someone tells you they don't have the time, tell them to make time, you know? And here's what I'll tell you about that. I'd been in a very stressful financial situation before this, where I'd had that high adrenaline and it basically took me out. And so I'd already known that you cannot do that. And after the first 24 hours in the hospital, again, standing in the pediatric ICU and going, all right, this is not a week long thing. This is now, at the time I didn't know it was going to be 7 years to get him to 110%, but I knew it wasn't going to be a month. And so that's where I went, I've got to show up here. I've got to show up for my family and I've got to do this book and I can't afford to get sick. You know, if I get sick, I cannot go and visit my son. I can't be here. You can't walk into the pediatric ICU if you've got a sniffle. It's just like now I look at what's going on with the pandemic, you know, it's like most people can't afford to get sick. And so what do you need to do? Like, is this a wake-up call so that we practice that self-care that we need to practice so that hopefully if we do get sick, we get through it quickly. And so that's what I did. I just made sure I'd walked in healthy already, but then I made sure I put the time in and I was getting to the hospital between 5:30 and 6 in the morning and usually leaving somewhere between 8 and 9 at night. I made sure that I got at least 8 hours of sleep. So whatever I had to do in there to swing that, so I got my 8 hours of sleep. I made sure that I had healthy food and I found a gym that was a quarter mile away and Whole Foods would deliver. And sometimes I just ran up and down the hospital stairs and took my son out and pushed him around once they could put him into more of a cardiac big wheelchair. But I just prioritized that. That my top priority was my self-care, so that, because if that wasn't there, I was not going to be able to do what I needed to do for my son. And I certainly wasn't going to be able to do what I need to do for that book launch. There were things coming up in that hospital on a regular basis that were life and death decisions, and that I had to be a part of, and you have to be able to think straight. So I think that we, you know, I surveyed my audience a couple years ago, and I said, if you are not where you want to be with your health, if you're not where you want to be with your weight, why not? And we just asked an open-ended question. And honestly, I thought that they would say, oh, can't give up my ice cream. You know, oh, you know, I thought it would be those, I don't have time, you know, something like that. But we had an overwhelming response. I mean, people writing pages. And the number one reason people told me they weren't where they wanted to be with their health was because they didn't feel worthy. They didn't feel like they were important enough. And so I always question when someone tells me they don't have time, right? Because you really vote with your time, don't you?
I think one of the things that can also happen when someone's in a caregiving role, as you were in such an intense way at this point, is they almost feel that they need to suffer alongside that person. That you know, that your son that is, you know, you love as much as anyone in the world. And it's like, well, who am I to go and feel good in my body and to exercise and to eat good food and get enough sleep? I have to sacrifice all of myself for him. And of course, the point that you're making, which I think is so important, is actually your act of love for him is also taking care of yourself.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, I think you've really got to flip that whole mindset, because if you want to be able to show up strong as a caretaker, and here's the thing, we are all going to go through tough times. I mean, I just had been fortunate that I'd gone through some really rough stuff before this one hit. And then I had an amazing mindset mentor at 30 who made this all a part of me. And I'd had chance to exercise it for years so that when this hit, it all was already in me. We know we're going to have tough times. And we know also that part of life is taking care of others. And if you have not taken amazing care of yourself, if you can't show up strong, you're not going to be able to take care of them. You're just not. And taking care, I've got a friend right now who was taking care of a loved one who had ALS, and then she came down with breast cancer because she was sacrificing herself. And we've got to so manage this, and it's possible. It is, but it first starts with that mindset shift of in order to take the best care of my son, in order to take the best care of my spouse, it first starts with making sure that I'm 100%, because I have no margin for error. That's what I knew. I go, what happens if I get sick and I cannot be at the hospital for him?
Well, it was to use a not perfect metaphor, it was like your Olympics, right? It was like the moment in your life that you wanted mm-hmm. to be at your greatest strength and your greatest capacity. And when someone goes to the Olympics, they're not out partying every night. They're taking care of themselves to perform
exactly
the best.
And here's the thing. I looked at my whole schedule. So that first night, the first 24 hours, I'm staying in the hospital. I'm realizing that, you know, I've got to make sure that I have my time for sleep and I get my exercise in very efficiently. I wasn't going to the gym for hours. I was like very efficient. I had good food. I went through and I go, what doesn't need to be in my life? I like the acronym ADD for this. What can you automate, delegate, delete? I literally looked and I went, there are so many things. Like someone who says, oh, I can't take care of myself. But look at all the stuff that you are doing that you really don't need to do. Someone could do it faster, better, cheaper. It just really doesn't matter at all if you do it anyway, you know, and you'll find that time. So I looked at this and I went, what all I have to do right now is make sure that I'm at the top of my game to be able to pull this off and be here for my son and sit bedside while I'm here with my son and make sure that I crush this book launch bigger than I ever imagine even bigger than that, so that my son, whatever I need to do to get him to 110% beyond, I can do.
So many people will, but some people maybe don't know what happened with the book launch. So just for folks that don't, tell them what happened.
So it was great because the hospital gave me a room to be able to do interviews. And since I was in LA, I could run if I had to do TV stuff. But my book was on the New York Times for 26 weeks. I broke my first $1 million in my business sitting bedside. I have a picture of me getting the news on my laptop. My business basically 10x'd. I reached, over a million people. I had a really successful public television special. And I'll tell you what's interesting. I wonder, would it have been that successful if if success wasn't optional here, wasn't mandatory? Like, I had to make that. There was no, I put myself already there with everything I'd invested in it. And I know it would have been successful, but the level that it was successful was beyond what I'd imagined. And I do think, there was no option there. It had to be. And I had such a bigger purpose. I always talk in business when I'm doing business coaches, coaching, or even when I'm doing weight loss and health coaching, I'm going, what is your why? And make sure that it's big enough to keep you moving forward. Well, I had a why that whatever happened, I was going to make darn sure. And we had all sorts of stuff blowing up during this thing, but all I saw was grand 110%. And this was one of the things that I had to do to get him there. So I was going to do whatever it took.
Yeah. It's an amazing story. And let's just complete then. And I know you said several times that it wasn't like Grant completed that first stage of rehabilitation that it was happily ever after. So just say a little bit about those. It sounds like, I guess it's 8 years ago that it happened. And you said it took 7 years mm-hmm. to get him back to 110%. So
yeah. Well, he's better than before the accident. It was very interesting. Prior to the accident, he'd struggled with what they thought was bipolar disorder. I never really felt like he fit anything. And so it was very interesting having him come out of a coma with some psych issues, and no one knew who the heck was going to wake up with, compounded with, when you have a brain injury, you lose your filter. So for him, he became super angry and violent and scary. And we never knew, like, you would start to see it between his, like, you'd get this furrow here, like the Incredible Hulk, and we're like, uh-oh, it's coming out. So that happened. And then the other thing that can happen with, and that cycled for years. Along with that, traumatic brain injuries can make people severely depressed. It's one of the highest risks for suicide. And he tried to kill himself multiple times too. In fact, when I was writing this book, he tried to kill himself. And I remember thinking, he's going to kill himself. Like, at some point you're not there 24/7. And I thought, well, he's going to kill himself and this book is coming out. And then I thought, this book is not about Grant's getting to 100%. This book is about how you show up. Right? And what you need to do. It's not the outcome. It's what you are doing moving towards that. But I'll tell you, like, I wasn't going down without a fight with him. I mean, I remember once.
That doesn't surprise me, JJ.
I was like, he'd had a knee surgery and he had all this pain and he needed more pain medicine. He'd taken all he could. And he goes, I'm going to go walk in front of a car and get hit by a car. And he had a walker and he wasn't supposed to put any weight on the knee. And I'm trying to hold him. And he's now like 180 pounds. I'm trying to hold him down.
And of all the ways he's threatening to end it, he's threatening to do it.
Right? I'm like, the hell you are. We just went through this. No, you're not. Anyway, he is now walking down the street with a walker. I'm trying to hold on to him. I'm calling 911. The paramedics are steaming down in a fire engine. And I thought, this is just ridiculous. But I kept telling him, we did not get to here for you to do this. Like, this doesn't end this way. Forget it. He swallowed a handful of pills once and it was like, same thing. The paramedics come and we are like piled on top of him, right? Holding him down. They're walking in, they're like, huh, the paramedics in our neighborhood got very, very used to this. But I just kept telling him, it's like, you're going to go through these things and come out of them. And then I just kept doing things. We did stem cells. We did biofeedback. We did hyperbaric. We just kept doing more and more stuff. And then I found a doctor who said, did you ever look at Lyme disease or any of the co-infections that could cause neural inflammation? What he had prior to the accident sounds like that. And it's that was the final thing that we've done is works with that and worked with an infectious disease doctor who works with another one in Africa and used all the special stuff. And Grand is now 110%. And it is the like wildest, craziest route to get there. But I think, you know, if you have the super clear why and this big vision goal, and you really get that the only limitations are the limitations in your mind, you just keep taking a step forward and step forward. And the path is like all over the place. We get here, right?
Yeah. If I was a kid going through an accident, I'd want you as my mum. I mean, it's an amazing testimony to you know, to you as a person, but also the teachings and the things that many things that had prepared you to that moment.
Well, and that's the takeaway that's really important. You know, I grew up, I'm adopted, my brother's schizophrenic. My dad had this really horrible death from cancer. An uncle like hung himself in the garage. I had, you know, we had some really challenging business things that happened. And I don't think I'm unusual. I think we all have these things. And that if you work through these, every time you go through these, there's lessons and silver linings in all of them. Heck, there's silver linings all over the place in the pandemic. And so, you know, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger, right? I mean, you just keep showing up and getting stronger. And then you look at the most successful people out there, it's not that they had the easy stick hit on them. It's really that they just have better resilience. They have more stress tolerance. They've had more life lessons and they've learned how to manage these things because we're all going to go through them. Yeah. I mean, might as well get good at it.
but that attitude is also a choice. Those silver linings, one can choose to see them or one can choose to not. And I think that's part of what's very inspiring about this story is what you went through is, as I said at the start, I think I can't imagine anything more traumatic that I could go through. But you made a number of choices along the way, which would not have always been easy choices about how you chose to respond to it.
Yep.
JJ, I'm mindful of time. For people that want to find out more about you and your work, we haven't even touched on in this interview our other body of work. We mentioned a few times your first book. But say a bit about where people can find out more and what people can find.
Everything's at my website, jjvirgin.com. I really see the mindset work to me is the most important of all, because once you have the mindset down, the rest of it becomes fairly, you know, then you just need strategies, right? But strategies without mindset, you're going to fail every single time. So you'll find I've got my blog, my podcasts, my YouTube channel, all sorts of recipes, programs, books, like anything you could need to be successful. But if I was going to say to start somewhere, I would start with the Warrior Mom and probably Miracle Mindset, the whole training we have through it.
Awesome. JJ Virgin, thank you so much for one of my favorite interviews of the conference. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.